So I'm gonna try something that I haven't done in a while, which is try to talk in a consistently coherent way. I often record into my voice memo on my phone, but just these little thoughts, and it doesn't seem right to publish such a thing. So I'm trying to sit down with this better mic and record. It's funny not to be able to stand. So bear with me. I'm sitting there this morning, a little tired, hadn't slept a whole lot, and I grab off a small bookshelf I have in my bedroom, a book, The Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu, translated by Ursula Le Guin. I don't know this book well. I haven't read other translations. I bought hers because, I don't know, you gotta choose. You read reviews, you choose your thing. It's great because she has these hilarious, brilliant, fan-freaking-tastic notes, sometimes just down below the poem. And they're just very conversational, and just she'll give a little read of something or make a little joke or sort of on-running commentary. It's sort of fantastic. It just is a rhetorical exercise, right? Just this on-running commentary, besides, of course, the translation being a version of her commentary. Anyway, I'm reading it, and I'm quite moved. You know, I'm just feeling that way. It's late, it's gray, it's Saturday, you know, a little melancholic. Not depressed, melancholic. Just it's the mood here in San Francisco right now. It's very gray, rainy, New Year. It's a time of reckoning. And so I'm reading this book, and I've read much of it before. I've read other books that had hit me more, so I bought this one. I had a little moment with it, and I put it away, and I'm reading it, and I'm feeling this sort of warmth, this surge, this kind of, that nice feeling of just like, yes, of import, that it's an affective moment. You know, I'm reading something, and I'm feeling this, the universe, and I find myself, I look up to the windows, and the window thing will matter in a moment. So I'm thinking, okay. You know, sometimes I was like, what? People read and they reread sort of these sacred texts, these canonical texts or something. I mean, think about, the Talmud and the Jewish tradition. You read the Torah throughout the course of the year, right? And then you read it again, you read it again, you read it again. And one way, of course, to look at reading it again is to be reminded. I'm reminded of these basic truths. But that was so clearly not the experience, or a different notion of remembering. Because for me, what happened when I'm reading this is that I am there. I'm participating in the universal becoming. It's not that it reminds me to do that. It's that in the very act of reading it and feeling these words come through me and in me and of me and with me, I am participating in the Tao. Right? It's not a reminder. It's an act, and it's very material in that sense. And I that's kind of what I think I want to talk about. Right? Is the sort of materiality of transcendence, or the materiality of knowledge? Because I can understand. Let's say I understand. I understand that I'm this. I'm just part of the cosmos. I'm a particle bouncing about. I'm, just another piece of stardust, right? And that's beautiful, and I get that, and I understand it. But of course, it's not that I forget it. It's that I start operating in a different economy, right? And I start operating in an economy sort of immediacy, the dings and dangs and pangs of the things very close to you, right? The traffic, job, family, friends, lovers, like you just start bumping into shit, right? And you're negotiating. For me, sometimes I look up at the sky and, whew, oh man, I look up at the sky and I'm there. It's not that I look up at the sky and I'm reminded that none of this matters. It's not that I look up in the sky and I look up at all the stars and I say, oh, I remember how insignificant I am. When I look up in the sky, I have that experience. I am doing that. I am in the freaking cosmos. I'm leaning into that, cosmic undulation that is the the atmosphere here, and it does other things somewhere else, but that's where it is here. And again, it's very material in that sense. And I go with those clouds, again, not as a reminder, but as that actual freaking experience, as that thing happening. One thing I really like having is my books out, my books on my bookshelf, you know? I mean, it might sound sort of banal, but we don't always have our books. I have a friend recently who had to throw away all his books, and so one of the luxuries I have now is an office with a bookshelf. Some books are locked away, but as many could fit on these shelves I have, and it's not like, I mean, they take up some space, but it's not like I'm constantly perusing them and, you know, looking for another book to read, you know. I read most of them. There are books on there I haven't read. I bought at some point hoping to read or look forward to reading. But that's not why they're there. They're not there to be read, right? They're there because when I just, out of the periphery of my eye, as I walk past them, sometimes I'll actually just turn and look at the shelf. And I'm not focusing on any one title. I'm not looking for a particular thing. There's just sort of this wash of book spines, of titles, of colors, of the little wears, you know, on the little tears or creases in the spines, the different fonts, the different colors. And each one is a kind of moment of that idea. And it's even more complicated, right? Because it's the moment of that idea as I lived it then, moving through time to this moment now, you know, so I look and I see, the bigger books pop out, right, because the bigger titles, but, you know, Truth and Method, Gadamer, my old beat-up copy, I actually opened it up recently, and it's filled with underlines in pen, underlines and comments in the corner throughout the entire book, and what a bold, cocky, young collegiate thing to do, to write in pen, Gadamer's Truth and Method. Anyway, when I look, I scan, I two things happen when that book just sort of enters my consciousness, enters my body, enters my eyes, enters, you know, is something that's perceived, is that I am one, that person again and still who read that book in a certain environment, in a certain course, with a certain professor, at a certain time in my life, with certain desires and certain events and certain set of moods and a certain way of making sense of the world. But then there's also the ideas, and the ideas that of Gadamer, right? The ideas of history as this sort of ground of earthly happening that we understand each other even across discontinuities through the mere fact that we're of the same stuff. And my point is that idea lives in the spine of the book on my shelf. So this idea that's sort of immaterial is also this idea that exists right then and there, right on that book with its colors and its fonts. And there's hundreds of books here, and each one is this sort of, It's this panoply. It's this multiplicity of ideas and moments and I'll say memories again. But what I want to emphasize is that their memory is not an abstraction. Memory is a participation. When I see all these things, all these books, all these spines, all these fonts, it's the presence of those ideas and those me's, those versions of myself, with me now, coexisting. Sometimes they parallel it and sometimes disjunctive. Sometimes, you know, like when you look at a picture of yourself and you don't quite recognize it, right? Sometimes it's disjunctive, but it's still a sort of co-presence or a participation with that thing. One way to think about it is as a scar, right? I mean, scars are memory of an event writ on the body. The fact is, of course, all of experience is writ on the body, just not always visibly, right? Everything that's perceived enters us. When you see something, when you touch it, when you smell it, when you experience it, when you live through it, when you have emotions and moods and ideas and thoughts and notions and images that flash through your brain, and you're taking in trees and leaves and cars and garbage and movies and, you know, life, they enter your body. They flow through your body. They are kinds of, you know, scars. If scar didn't have a negative connotation, they are constitutive of your present state of becoming. They're not determinative. They don't determine who you are. You're not a sum of these things, but they exist as a kind of co-presence, right? I mean, that scar doesn't, it's not all of me, but it's constitutive of me. My point, of course, through all this is what's always sort of intrigued me, which is the materiality of the invisible and the materiality of the transcendent. And of course, the intertwining, or the, you know, Merleau-Ponty calls the chiasmus, but the marbling, the way the physical world and the psychic invisible world, affective world, how they interact and how they intersect and how they actually inflect each other. Here's an obvious example. I was just thinking of, you know, when you have a new baby and they're crying their eyes out. The thing a new parent learns very quickly is change environment, right? So the kid's shrieking, so you walk outside. Kid, stop shrieking. We do this, of course, in our own lives too, right? You're feeling funny. I did this just last night. I opened all my windows. It's cold and rainy here, but I just needed to change the environment. I was just in a flow, right? And my mood changes, right? I I do something in the world. I change where I am. I change my environment. I change the air. I change the temperature. I change my movement. I change my speeds. And the way I perceive the world, my very mechanisms, invisible, of making sense of this world, including my affect, my mood, they change. That's incredible. And of course, we know the other side of that, right? When you're feeling great, you know, everything all of a sudden is great, looks great, smells great, tastes great, you know. These two worlds inflect each other, right? There is a persistent materiality to the invisible world. Another way to think about this is, you know, Castaneda has this, this notion of the power place, these sites of power. And he goes out walking with Don Juan. Don Juan always instructs him to find the place. You decide where to sit. And it seems like, you know, it's a moment of reckoning. And I think, well, in that environment, it seems so poignant, right? Where are you going to sit? In fact, we know that all the time, right? In movie theaters and restaurants, where are you going to sit? What's the right table? Do you like this table? Not like this table? Why? Because the flows of forces, of magnetism, of gravity, for lack of better words, that those forces of that we already ascribe names and values to, quantitative values like gravity and magnetism. But there's all sorts of other forces, all kinds of pulls and pushes and tugs, social and cosmic and physical, and they move through a space, and you know, you decide you want to sit there or not sit there, because it's how your body handles that particular flow of forces. I can't go to a movie theater that has other people. You know, I can't stand people around me in my periphery, like, especially if they're eating popcorn, which I find grotesque, especially during a movie. It's not a snobby thing. It's simply an aesthetic thing. It's because I believe it's wrong. It's because it actually grosses me out. It's really an aesthetic, not an ethical judgment. But, you know, we experience this all the time. You know, change my table, put me somewhere else. You got to find the right position for how your body inflects the flow. So, you know, to tie it all back together, to stitch it all together, you know, I'm rereading the Tao Te Ching. I reread a book. in order to experience those things again. Not to remind myself, not to say, oh yeah. It's because it's something that is lived through, right? It's not something simply that's understood. It's something that's lived through, that's participated in. When I look up at the clouds, when I look up at the sky, I'm not reminded that I am like them. Like I am like the stars, or I am just so much, you know, stardust. It's that I actually flow like that. I participate with those things.